97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
It's so damn hot. Milk was a bad choice.
Oh, yeah. We only play that when we have triple-digit heat indices, and we have that today. I think it's 94. The good news is we've got a cool front coming in here.
Oh, we do?
Wednesday. Like, Wednesday's high is going to be 81, so like 94 right now feels like 102. Same thing for tomorrow, but Wednesday's high, only 81, and I think Thursday, Friday, the same thing. So look, I still will make the case that we're getting off pretty easy here with summer. It was a little sticky over the weekend. Are we getting also, I think we got a little haze today from the wildfires.
Yeah, I noticed it this morning.
Yeah.
I was looking for it. Is that what that was?
I think it is.
All right.
You know, thankfully we weren't hit as bad as, you know, Detroit and Cleveland and New York City and a lot of these places. Although, didn't the skies open up quite nicely in New Jersey yesterday for the World Cup final? I mean, you could not have had better weather for that. It was right around 80 degrees, clear skies after everything that they had experienced. I mean, that could have been a much different experience for fans and the players had the weather not been very good. And if it was set for 2 days earlier, I'm not so sure they wouldn't have probably have had to postpone it because
how
of the
crazy
way the skies
would
look, right?
Been, yeah. Having to postpone a World Cup final. I mean, there may not be a bigger event in the world that you would have to change the time of it. That would have been crazy. So glad it worked out.
But I would say, you know, with all the fears that people had going into it and, you know, the negativity, that it was a pretty big success. We're going to have Andrew Bailey on a little bit later. You know, he's the assistant director of the FBI. He did a lot of stuff when it came to the security for the World Cup. And they're kind of like saying, Fred, even this was like preparing for, you know, 78 Super Bowls, right?
Yeah.
With the level of security. So a successful World Cup. Look, if we're speaking candidly about the games themselves, I missed most of the England-France game, but I did see the highlights, and that was mind-blowingly entertaining, right?
It was really good. The best game of all of them, I think.
And then yesterday's was kind of a dud from a game perspective because, look, you know, if you watched it, you know Spain was controlling the whole thing, and Argentina looked like they might get lucky again with something like they managed to do against Egypt and some of these other teams. But I think the better team overall won, and it was a great experience. And I think the Europeans really, really enjoyed their time here in the U.S. And, you know, you're going to have criticism of Trump, and he was there trying to take pictures with the Spaniards and everything, and people are complaining about that. But overall, I would say a really, really good World Cup experience. And look, this is from someone who's not into the beautiful game that much, but I really enjoyed watching it. Now, we had the pregame ceremonies yesterday and the halftime show, and there appears to be a bit of a divide on whether or not that was good or not. We'll get to that here in a second because I haven't talked to the team and I don't know where everyone is. One thing I will say, now, Sue, I'll ask you because I asked you to watch the halftime show.
Yes.
Did you watch any of the game at all?
Nope.
Okay. Well, you didn't
one
miss,
nothing
you
or
didn't miss
nil,
much.
Whatever.
Did you hear any of the national anthem by any chance?
I did not.
Okay, so Jennifer Hudson, here we go.
Oh, can you see?
So I will tell you, and I'm going to get to the part here at the end here. I mean, she was great.
Wow. Nailed it.
She's awesome.
So I'm just going to be honest with you. I'm going to tell you, I'm sitting in my basement watching this yesterday, and I got emotional watching Jennifer Hudson do the national anthem. I really did. I'm watching all these people and the teams prepare for battle and thinking about our country and freedom in 250 years. Honestly, I got a little teary-eyed, and I was not expecting that. I really did. So then, you know, the game starts. Actually, they did something a little different. So they did the national anthem, and then they did this song that was like the FIFA. Do we have any of that? I don't think I had you pull that.
Did.
I thought that was pretty good. So then you get to the halftime show. You got everyone up there on the you know, on the stage, they're breaking down the game. They're talking about, you know, the ins and outs, blah, blah, blah. And then they get to the halftime show. And because of the halftime show, it's a longer halftime.
I think
it's
10 minutes longer.
10 minutes longer, right. Oh, wait, one thing I have to do here because I forgot about her. Oh, the woman who did the Argentina national anthem. Two things. Maybe three things, okay? All right, three things. One.
I know.
Super hot, okay?
I knew it.
Two, really, really good. Three.
Three.
Super hot. Did I mention that? Because.
Yeah, what was she wearing?
I don't know, but I'm a fan. I'm like, I was going for Spain until she sang the national anthem of Argentina.
Okay, I gotta look her up.
So she, and you know what was cool about that? Like, Spain, nothing wrong.
Look up woman who sang.
Yeah, national anthem singer.
When Mark got here today, I said, did you see who sang the Argentina national anthem? He said, pull that too. Pull that too.
Because she was phenomenal. But the thing that was kind of cool about that, honestly, was that the Spain national anthem was just horns, and there were no words to it that I'm aware of. I'm not sure. But everyone, like the team, Messi, all the Argentinians, there were more, you know, people from Argentina that were in that crowd than fans for Spain. But she was really, really good. Okay. So then
I like the players. They just don't sing it. They scream it.
Oh, yeah. They were screaming it. Yeah, it was really cool. So that was fun. So then you have the halftime show. Okay, so it opens with Madonna. And most of it with Madonna, I think, is pre-recorded, and then she comes kind of out of the
100%.
Tunnel. 100%! Right, yeah. You know, so they did this, but they do these things at these shows. So she comes out. My most important thing with Madonna is don't embarrass yourself, because one thing I know is that she shouldn't be shaking her hips like Shakira, because Shakira, well, her hips don't lie, and they still don't lie. Let me tell you something. So Madonna goes into the Muppets. Muppets maybe a little weird, right?
Okay, that was
but
weird.
It was fun factor, I thought.
I liked that part. The end was...
All right, wait, we're not at the end yet. We're still in the middle.
Sorry.
So the Muppets are doing stuff. And then Jason Sudeikis does a little Ted Lasso.
Loved it.
Coach, I gotta say, the first half of halftime knocked my darn socks off.
Spectacular, baby.
I mean, how the heck is anyone gonna be able to follow all that?
Gonna be tough.
Yep. Yeah, you know what I think we need? We need some heart. You know, someone that has some soul. You know, someone who can bring the love. Who? You think of what I'm thinking?
One step ahead of you, coach.
You always are. All right, young man, let's go. It's your big shot. Okay. Now listen to me. Go out there. Don't be nervous. Nobody's watching.
I loved this.
So, but that part, okay, that was weird because Justin Bieber, wait, let me get to Shakira with the hips don't lie, because Shakira's out there. Man, she looks good. She's like almost 50 years old, right?
Yeah.
And she's doing her thing. And then there's a lot of energy to it, a lot of choreography. And then Justin Bieber comes out and he kind of, and I told Becky, I'm like, if I run into this guy at the QT, I don't know he's Justin Bieber, because he's got beard now. He looks very different. And the song was okay, but I didn't understand if they were trying to create some time to do the last number or not.
Okay.
So it was,
wait,
it was weird.
Can I comment, please?
Yes, please do.
I thought he was awesome. And he was the only live performer. And I thought he did a fantastic job. And I liked the song.
Oh, I don't take... I actually
liked
it, too.
So it wasn't lip-synced, and there he was. I thought he was the best part of it.
Okay, to me, it was the it was just the energy. It wasn't the performance. It wasn't the song. It was just that it came from, you know, where all this energy happened. And then they had Chris Martin and the kids and Coldplay and stuff, and a lot of colors on the field. Now, look, I went on. I think that this was a better, by far, halftime show than anything that recently the NFL has put on because of all their wokeness and crap. So I text Ethan that, and Ethan, completely different experience, right?
I was not a big fan of it. I thought you know, the way you describe it, it doesn't sound like we're that far off. I love Justin Bieber. The performance put me to sleep. I like the song, but not for a halftime show. The Muppets, Madonna. I thought Shakira's was the best part, but that three. What year is it? Is it 2005? Like,
what,
I mean,
he goes, "What I'm is it? 2004?" Like,
so I think the kids part was super weird at the end. Where I mean,
I
like the World Cup always.
Why was
kind
that
of,
weird?
It was weird.
What do you mean? How
Why?
Was that weird?
How was
a bunch of kids singing, you know, "We love each other, unity." Like, I mean, this is it a bad message? No, but like, it's just weird.
It
so
wasn't good.
It just felt like they were. It was
Fred
kind
and I
of
are on a different page.
It
right?
felt very gimmicky yeah. to me. Great. And listen, I'm not gonna say that the Super Bowl halftime shows have been good the last couple of years, but to argue that if this would have been the Super Bowl halftime show, that this would have been worlds better, I would have said that I thought that this overall was pretty lame, too.
Okay, I liked it. I thought it was good. It was entertaining.
Did
it
too.
Didn't make me feel like it was embarrassing, like Bad
no.
Bunny or anything else like that. I don't understand where they hate. So here's this guy. What's this guy's name from the British coverage? Wayne Rooney? Is he a former player?
A
I don't
very,
even know.
Very world-renowned former
so,
player.
So Wayne Rooney is world-renowned former player of the beautiful game, and here's what he said.
I when it finished.
Enjoy it.
I like a lot of the matters, but I thought it was crap.
That is so miserable. That's it, honestly.
Tell you what else you get on the BBC, honest reviews.
What about the Macarena? Can I get to you?
Just didn't get me going.
I think it was Bieber that kind of brought you down, wasn't it? I think Bieber was a bit slow for you.
Yeah, I didn't like the Yanks. They didn't like the show. So I don't know. Is there anyone chiming in on the feed right now? Because I was really surprised that people didn't like it as much as they didn't like it, because I thought it was
people
really
never
good.
Like anything. Well, that's what I've decided.
That's kind of the thing. Like, what is the win here for someone doing one of these shows? Because they get ripped no matter what happens, right? Yeah,
maybe I'm from the older crowd, but I liked it a lot because I think I knew all the songs. I knew the words. And it kind of made sense to me what was going on, even though it was disjointed at times. It kept moving.
I thought it was just a big celebration of the end of the World Cup. So what's wrong with that?
Except the kids were weird. But yes.
Maybe I got to rewatch that part because I didn't think the kids were weird.
Some of them couldn't sing, which was weird. And I liked the Muppets up front, but at the end,
just felt kind of cheesy to me. Yes. Like I said, I will say this. I'm thankful that a bunch of agenda wasn't shoved down our throats, that there wasn't like this massive ugly messaging behind it, or that like one side of the country or the world is like evil. I'm glad that wasn't there. But it's from an entertainment perspective, I was like, I thought it could have been better.
Okay, but in the end here, as I take a break and Josh Hammer's coming up, one thing I think we can all agree on is the woman who did the Argentina national anthem is super hot. We're coming back. Jacob Olador is going to join us at the bottom of the hour. He is the Chief Research Officer and Director of American Security at the America First Policy Institute. He'll have the latest on Iran. We're going to talk about that a little bit here. Also with our next guest, Josh Hammer, back with us. Newsweek Senior Editor at Large. He hosts the Josh Hammer Show. You hear it Saturdays at 1 p.m. on 97.1 FM Talk. Josh, good Monday afternoon to you. How are you?
Mark, I'm doing great, my friends. How are you doing?
Good. Our main debate here has been on the World Cup halftime show. Did you see it, and would you like to weigh in?
You know, I watched the whole game, but I actually went for a little walk during halftime, to be honest with you. So I caught very, very little of it. So I feel ill-equipped to weigh in. I do
Fair
feel
enough.
Well-equipped to weigh in on the fact that Spain just totally kicked Argentina's butt, much to my chagrin, unfortunately.
Yeah, they dominated Argentina. There's no doubt about that. All right, so let me start with Mayor Mamdani in New York City here, because he wants to talk about arresting Bibi if Bibi comes to New York City.
I believe that Prime Minister Netanyahu belongs in The Hague. He's a war criminal who has been charged by the International Criminal Court. And what you will find is that is an opinion that is held by many purely because of what his actions have wrought over these last many years. I've also said that I will follow the laws that we have here in New York City because I believe that there's an importance in following the law as a leader who presides over our city. Whatever the law allows me to do in New York City, that's what we will do, but we won't be writing our own laws to that end.
All right, Josh, I'm a little confused by that only because he's saying that Bibi is a criminal. My impression, based on his visit last week at Rikers Island with, you know, inmates, that he liked criminals, that he likes to cozy up to criminals. So maybe some mixed messaging there from Mayor Mamdani, but what do you think of all that?
Well, it's hard to know where to begin with this one, Mark. First of all, the United States has not authorized the Rome Statute, which is the treaty that the rest of the world, or not the rest of the world, but a lot of other countries have signed, to bring the ICC into their jurisdiction. So both the United States and Israel, for that matter, neither country has signed the Rome Statute. So the ICC has no jurisdiction whatsoever here on American soil. The ICC is a total kangaroo court unto itself. I actually brought on Eugene Kontorovich, a great international legal expert, on my show, Josh Hammer Show, last week to talk about it. Marco Rubio last week declared war on the ICC. He said the United States will work with like-minded countries to dismantle it because it is a rogues gallery court. It is a court that ironically, contrary to its name, does the bidding of the world's tyrants. They have never sought out to arrest people like Vladimir Putin or Kim Jong-un. Rather, they just try to arrest people like Bibi Netanyahu. Now, on the actual law itself, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Mike Waltz, had a really helpful post over the weekend on X laying out all the reasons why this never in a million years will possibly succeed. First of all, Congress has passed a law that says that there is blanket immunity for those who travel to New York City for purposes of going to the United Nations, which by the way, means that even if there's an actual international terrorist, even someone like Bashar al-Assad, for instance, if he were to come here to New York City trying to go to the United Nations, we actually could not arrest him. So the same standard surely would apply in this case to a rogues gallery court trying to arrest Netanyahu. The most obvious thing, though, is that whatever Mamdani wishes to be the case, It doesn't really matter because, dude, you're the mayor of a city, and it happens to be like a large city, but you don't get to weigh in or to act on foreign policy geopolitical questions. That is the terrain of Congress and the federal government. But ultimately, none of this, Mark, as you know, is actually about the law. It's all about a stunt. This is a stunt. It is a pure PR stunt move by Zohar Mamdani, just trying to burnish his anti-Israel, anti-Bibi credentials before his DSA base. Mamdani's having a moment. He's now the kingmaker in the DSA. You could argue he's the kingmaker of the whole Democratic Party, which frankly says a lot as to where they're at these days. So he's just trying to burnish his credentials, and ultimately this is really about nothing more than that, I would say.
Some people are, by the way, on the DSA stuff, we have our own candidate here in Cori Bush who's trying to weasel her way back into Congress, and you have to wonder if she might not be able to do that just based on what's happened in New York and some of these other states. Even Van Jones on CNN says,
I'm tired of people on the very far left in the Democratic Party, my party, telling us that in order for progressives, we now have to believe ideas and support ideas that are completely nuts. These are terrible ideas. These are awful ideas. Where did these ideas even come from?
So Van Jones knows they're terrible ideas, but they seem to be latching on with some of the voters out there who are choosing these DSA candidates. And I know that you wrote a column, just about economics, and you worry about these younger people in what they think might be their future and why they are latching on to some of this stuff successfully when you got Bernie out there and AOC spreading the Communist Manifesto.
Socialism, Mark, is the deadliest ideology in the history of the human species. Like literally bar none. The estimated death toll for socialism / communism is estimated to be 100 million, potentially even or more. Most of that happening in the Soviet Union and really above all, ultimately in Mao's China, just over the course of the last century. It's really scary to see this sort of stuff making a comeback. This is not just college kids who have smoked a little too much pot and are riffing at 3 a.m. over the guitar and saying, oh, socialism, man, let's just share the wealth. No, this is worse than that. This is the mayor of the nation's largest city, among others, who are pushing this thing into the mainstream. And, don't just take it from me. I thought Bill Maher gave a fascinating interview with Jonathan Carl yesterday on ABC's This Week program, where he basically said, look, people are saying that this is not communism, it's quote-unquote just socialism, but he says, don't tell me that I can't see with my eyes. I mean, when you have people like Mamdani quoting the Communist Manifesto, this is scary stuff, and it's ultimately not just a nice policy disagreement about economic policy. We're talking here about totalitarianism and the various means that could be used to implement that. But that's where the party's at. I mean, the polling says that's where they're at. The recent Pew Gallup polling that I've seen on this shows that socialism has a much higher approval rating currently within the Democratic Party than capitalism. It's not even particularly close, by the way. So listen, you have Ken Martin, who's the DNC chair. You have Hakeem Jeffries, Chuck Schumer, whatever remains of the Democrat establishment. I guess some of them are trying to push back against this. Van Jones is now the establishment, I guess.
I know, that's shocking.
Right. But, I mean, whatever remains of the establishment, they're pushing back against this. But it's not going to work because the young people are on the side of socialism and all the momentum is on their side as well. So I hate to say it because I'd rather America's left-center party not be totally off the walls, bat-crap crazy, but I do predict that the Democrats will be a broadly socialist party potentially as soon as the turn of this decade, 2030, but at least
it's
the next
happening.
50 years.
Yeah, it is rolling for sure. Josh Hamber with us, Newsweek senior editor-at-large. What did you think of the president's nationwide address last week? I mean, as I headed into Friday, did my Friday show and spent the weekend, I don't hear anyone really talking about that, even a lot of the pundits online. I was a little confused by it, but what was your thought? I mean, look, if there's election, malfeasance going on, we should root that out, but relitigating the 2020 election is not something I think the American people, nor am I, interested in.
So I thought it was fascinating that Donald Trump did not actually literally talk about the 2020 election. In mild fairness, he talked a lot about how the Chinese have gotten our voter data. He didn't actually do the whole, overnight 4 a.m. ballot drop in Michigan. There was, I thought there might have been some of that. There actually wasn't any of that in his defense. There was some important stuff in the speech. I think the fact that between 200,000 and 300,000 illegal aliens are currently on voter rolls, I thought that that was definitely a bit of an eye-opener, and I did not realize that it was quite
It's a big number.
That high.
Yeah.
It's a massive number. I think that the speech, Mark, can easily be understood as a Hail Mary play when it comes to trying to get the Save America Act passed. That's what this was. This is a speech that was gearing up for the admittedly somewhat terse conclusion, which was a strong push to get the Save America Act passed. And it shows you that Trump is actually really serious about this. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but this is not just an idle-brained tweet or a true social post. He's actually really serious about this bill getting passed. Look, rightly or wrongly, your mileage may vary. Donald Trump is without question convinced that there is rampant voter fraud in this country and that he was denied the 2020 election, which was rightfully his. And again, you can love that, you can hate that, but he is absolutely convinced of it. And I think that some of what was unveiled supports that thesis. What I will say, though, Mark, is I was hoping that he might use this address to actually talk a little bit more about the Iran war, I've been saying for months on my show that this is overdue. We are overdue to hear from the commander-in-chief what exactly are we doing, what exactly are the war aims, and how can we discern that our job is done here and that we can declare victory and get out.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more on that. I'm going to talk a little bit more with Jacob Oledort on that in just a couple of minutes. But Josh, thank you so much. By the way, just a curious question. I'm just kind of taking the temperature in case people have seen it. Did you go to see The Odyssey, and are you if you didn't?
I have not, but it's funny, Mark. I actually was asked my wife about an hour ago if we can get a babysitter tomorrow night for a date night to go see it. I'm a huge Christopher Nolan fan, and I want to see this movie for myself. I heard a lot of mixed thoughts, but I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, that's where I am too. So I want to see it in 70mm, so I'm going to do that. And I missed the screening last week. Josh, always great. The Josh Hammer Show, 1 p.m. Saturday afternoon. It's 97.1 FM Talk. We'll talk soon. Thank you.
Take care, Mark.
All right. Well, look, lots of questions. You know, we touched on this with Josh Hammer about the situation in Iran. And we're going to find out here from Jacob Oledort where he thinks this is heading. But I want to play a little bit of Marco Rubio because this is what the Secretary of State says.
I also think it's pretty growing apparent. That even within their own system, there's a growing split. I think maybe some of your outlets have documented this. Between those that understand that their economy is in shambles and they need to do something, or they're going to be in a lot of trouble very soon, economically, domestically, and others who are very militant in their view of life and in their view of the world and continue to launch missiles. So they'll have to work out that split internally. We're going to continue to respond. If the door opens to diplomacy, if the guys that want to do something productive for Iran win and take control of that system or take control of the negotiations, that'll be a very positive development. That's not where we are tonight.
Okay, meantime, we have, you know, American troops that unfortunately have been killed.
Those great people, those great patriots were out there fighting that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. But we hit them very hard again tonight, and we did that in honor of the probably three, as opposed to two. Great patriots.
So Jacob Oledort back with us, Chief Research Officer and Director of American Security at the American First Policy Institute. Jacob, welcome back. How are you this afternoon?
Great to be with you. Doing well. How are you?
I'm good, but I'm confused. Like when the Secretary of State talks about doors opening to, you know, diplomacy, I thought that door was open several weeks ago when they had the memo of understanding, which seemingly has not held together at all. So are we getting mixed messaging from the administration?
Well, not at all. No, this is all consistent, and it's great to be with you and your listeners. This is a big escalation by the Iranian regime over the last few weeks. But at the end of the day, what we're doing right now, what the United States is doing, is something transformational for a generation. I mean, this is ending really an architecture 5 decades in the making of creating terror against the United States and against innocents around the world. And so that's a process, and diplomacy is always the first option, but it never comes at the expense of obviously military pressure, economic pressure. And that's what we're seeing take place right now.
Well, I think some people might be confused because, look, we're striking them pretty hard. And, you know, one of my reactions, I've heard this out there from other people, too, is like, how much harder can we strike them? I mean, how can we still be in a situation where militarily we're still inflicting more and more pain when we've hit so many targets in the first place? I know it's a big country. Maybe that's part of it. What would your answer be on that, Jacob?
Well, there are a number of – it's a good question. And obviously there are still targets we can hit, some of the critical infrastructure, for example, that has been discussed, which would be fair game given how the regime uses it for its military means. But it's a higher question as well as what kind of pressure actually imposes pain and costs on the regime. Some of that, I think, as the Secretary of State alluded, is a little bit of a wait and see mode to see which of the wings within their echelons prevails and letting them kind of fight among themselves over it. Another piece of it is looking around the region at pressure points. And so I think as part of that, the Lebanon diplomacy has been very important. The arrival of the Prime Minister of Iraq in Washington last week was another important point. These, I think if we focus more intensely on each of these areas outside of Iran's borders, I think actually that could apply even more direct pressure on the regime. But of course, maintaining that military pressure directly as well and the naval blockade are part of that. So it's a multi-front effort.
But do you have any sense of who the different players are inside Iran that we might be dealing with? Are there factions that have become clear, or is that sort of still a mystery?
They generally are clear. I mean, and what it is look, you've had this competition for several years between the foreign ministry and the IRGC. But right now, it's effectively the IRGC that's in a dominant position there, which has been pretty skeptical of negotiations. They are, I think, increasingly calling the shots, literally and figuratively there. But then you also have the foreign ministry types that have always preferred that diplomatic approach. You know, all that being said, the intentions are the same, it's just the tactics. But I do think right now, you know, they're kind of in an unprecedented situation of leadership vacuum and having to sort it out from themselves, which, you know, it's not the worst thing to have our enemies in a state of chaos like that.
How do you react? I mean, Kuwait was hit, and they say one of its power and water, you know, desalinization plants were attacked for the second time in 2 days. And obviously, we're hitting some of the Iranian infrastructure right now. But one of the things that they said is that even though their power grid is stable, in Kuwait, about 90% of that water comes from the desalination. I think I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. Yep. I think I got it right the second time. So thoughts on that? I mean, there has to be a response. You can't let that keep happening, right?
Absolutely. And look, in Kuwait in particular obviously knows this very well. I mean, having suffered the Iran-Iraq war and the invasion of Iraq several decades ago, I think that's all exactly right. And I think the longer this continues, the more aligned all of our regional and global allies will be in wanting to stand up for, you know, against the regime. You know, I think, you know, how Kuwait will respond is one thing to watch. I mean, it's noteworthy that the UK in the last 2 weeks finally came around to designating the IRGC as a terror organization. I mean, it's small fries in one sense, but it's, you know, I think it's a sign that there is a consensus forming, and I think that's part of what we're doing here. You know, we don't want to take full ownership, nor should we, over what happens in this vast, you know, country in the day after. But building that coalition to plan for that, I think that is part of the intent here, and that takes time.
You know, it's interesting. Jacob Olador is here. I feel like I learned a lot, and hopefully the audience learns a lot from conversations with you about this. But I still think there's a sense, and I talked about this a little bit in the previous segment with my friend Josh Hammer, that, you know, the president needs to go out there and make a stronger case for what we're doing. We thought we might get some of that on Thursday night. But Jacob, it seems like you and some other folks, and I have Jim Talent on here quite a bit, make a better case for this and explain it better than the president does. And that leaves, look, it's hard enough for me to understand geopolitics, but most people, what they see are gas prices, right?
No, it's a fair point. And look, there is real pain to American families at the pump, but I think there's a broader context here. And I think the president's been doing a fantastic job explaining it. I think you're right. There are several factors going on right now. But I do think, you know, one thing we can always go back to is his own instinct and record, really, on Iran, not just the many decades as a civilian, but also obviously in the first term and Soleimani, the actions he took. So I think that's consistent. The other piece is kind of how we think about the future. And here, you know, what I go back to is, look, this waterway has been under attack for many decades by Iran. So it's right to focus on the pain in the present, the gas pump, but that pain has been there all along in some form, given the risk by the regime. What's actually going to happen here, once the regime is no longer able to threaten this waterway, well, I mean, companies, insurers will be able to look at this and say, look, it's a different risk landscape than we're used to. There might actually be a higher degree of confidence and stability in this part of the world. I don't want to talk about the exact price of gas. I know there's a little bit, you know, it's a bit of an art there, but I'm very confident in terms of the stability that we're going to see because of this. And I think that alone is the context for patience and, you know, really letting us take the time we need to do the job to its conclusion.
Well, and I think part of it is finishing the job. Now, if we would have gone back, I'll ask this as a final question. We'd go back a month to June 20th, and I don't even know if that was around the time that the Memorandum of the Understanding came out. But if I were to have asked you or anyone else, or just to kind of, you know, look into the crystal ball on July 20th, are we still going to be in this thing the way we are? Will we have finished the job? Well, the answer is no. So if we look ahead another month, because one of the concerns that I think a lot of people have, including me, is that this thing, you know, the timetable is getting way, way stretched out from what the expectations were. So how do you finish the job? That I think that's really what people want to know.
Right. Well, it's a good question, and it sounds abstract. It's very concrete and specific. And what that means is, look, eliminating Iran's ability to threaten Americans through its military, you know, infrastructure. So that's part one. And part two, I think, is ensuring we have that coalition in place. Now, that takes time. And I think the surprise for the United States is that our European allies that have always been hand in hand with us in every military engagement are completely sitting out this one. That puts more of a burden on us and other partners. But I think there's a lot to be hopeful for. You have Israel, you have the UAE, you have other countries stepping up against this threat, coming together. I think that's kind of the picture we have to look at as far as the future. And really, that is the America First model of burden sharing, making our partners take ownership for the security and prosperity of their own regions so that Americans don't need to worry about it.
Great conversation, Jacob, as always. Really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on this afternoon. All right, take care. This is one of those strange situations, and, you know, I always am very skeptical when I see things, even from, you know, even from websites or from outlets that I trust. But there was something that had gone around over the weekend about a flag that was hung upside down at a fire station here in St. Louis. Now, my first reaction to that is no way. That's not something that would have happened, because of all places, like, why would you do that at a fire station? So Libs of TikTok goes out there, and they've been outing this. They do this a lot, and I think a lot of you are familiar with what they do on TikTok and on Twitter, but they've been updating people throughout the weekend. So you said you might have heard about this a little bit this morning, right?
I thought so.
Yeah. So, you know, the first thing that they did on that site, which has, you know, let me see here, because I'm on there right now. They have almost 5 million followers. Okay, it's like 4.7 million followers on that website, and they post a lot, so I'm going to have to page down here. But the first thing they did is they posted the picture of the fire station that said, hey, is this what's going on here in St. Louis? So then that takes off, and people start responding to that. And then again, the first question is, well, is it real? Is it something that really happened? And then they did an update. So the first one literally said, fire station in St. Louis, Missouri, flying the American flag upside down, absolutely disgraceful. Fix this ASAP at STL Fire Department. So then there's an update from the fire department. The only local outlet that I think has done a story on this is KSDK, and I'll get to that here in a second. So the official X account for the St. Louis Fire Department says the St. Louis Fire Department is aware of an American flag that was displayed upside down at one of our fire stations. The flag was corrected immediately after the matter was brought to our attention. An administrative investigation has been initiated to determine the circumstances surrounding the incident. We have the utmost respect for the American flag and the values it represents. We take this matter seriously. And they should take it seriously.
Well, yeah.
But again, it doesn't make any sense that it happened. Like, did someone inside the fire station do that, or did someone outside of the fire station?
Oh, well, that's actually a good point.
Well, right. So the KSDK story, and again, I don't think that anyone else has done this outside of some of the national outlets that are, you know, posting this or you know, spreading the word about it. Channel 5 story says the St. Louis Fire Department has launched an administrative investigation after American flag was flown upside down. Really, they're not telling you anything more than the tweet said, right?
Right.
Basically, you right. know. An investigation into circumstances is underway, and then they kind of go into the flag code where American flag should never be displayed upside down, except as a signal of dire distress in instances of extreme danger to life or property. So, but more often, let's face it, people use that as protest. So was it a protest? Was it an accident? Was it someone that vandalized it? I think, you know, that's something that we certainly would want to find out.
Huh.
Let me play just a couple of pieces of audio. I'll probably get into this maybe in 2 hours with audio cut of the day, but Josh Hammer responded to this and said something earlier in the hour. And, you know, we're talking a lot about these DSA candidates, of which we have one here in St. Louis with Cory Bush, thoroughly and you know, emphatically endorsed by the Democrats Socialists of America. So, you know, I think people who listen know I'm a fan of Bill Maher, and, you know, I've used him quite a bit when it comes to Audio Cut of the Day. If I had some sort of power rankings for Audio Cut of the Day, Trump would have it, no doubt. I mean, there's no one that's going to ever exceed over the course of these last 10 years being Audio Cut of the Day. There should be some sort of trophy involved. I think.
Should, so, yeah.
But Bill Maher's up there with a number of them because he's just a common sense guy. And I might not agree with him on everything, but I always kind of mention this. Interestingly enough, the Reardon Roundtable was actually fashioned and modeled after his show in the 1990s, which was called Politically Incorrect. So he inspired me because he would have conversations with people of different political stripes even back then. And he's not afraid to share his opinions even when they're not popular. So he goes on, whose podcast was, I think Jonathan Carl did one of these interviews. And I think maybe he was talking with Rogan on one of the other ones. Anyway, he's talking about the DSA.
Every day I read about a new person in some Colorado and Wisconsin, somebody who is saying some variation of not defund the police, abolish the police. No prisons, no police. Like, what world do they think we could possibly live in under these conditions?
Yeah, so that's still the stuff that they're spreading out there. And, you know, these Democrat Socialist candidates are getting a lot of attention. They're getting people to vote for them. It seems that the only person on the Democrat side of the aisle who's taking a stand against this and raising the issue and saying, what are you thinking, is John Fetterman.
Of course.
And then he's also threatening, look, there's a, you know, he's talking about a dividing line there with Israel, a red line that can't be crossed as well, and then he may become a Republican, which would be interesting. But even Bill Maher says, look, my vote is in play.
You told J.D. Vance you're open, your vote is up for grabs.
Yes, my vote is in play, because it can't be Trump running. Mm-hmm. So I'm not living in communist America. I mean, I know the talking point is that, well, it's not communism, it's socialism. Okay, I've read the quotes from the DSA platform, from their own mouths. Don't tell me I'm not seeing what I am seeing.
Thank you.
And DSA, again, they say things like, you know, takeover of key industries, government. That's communism.
Yeah, it is communism. And Bill's calling it exactly what it is. Now, listen to this. This is great. And I give Fox credit. I guess the people from these organizations want to go on and spread their nonsense. This guy doesn't sound very smart, but he's on with Martha McCallum talking about landlords in New York City, okay?
Landlords in New York have been making a 12% return on their investment for, on
average. How much should they make? What's fair for the landlord to make if you don't like 12?
They're complaining that 12 is not enough. And we don't think that anyone should have a constitutional right to double-digit returns on their investment. That's why we've implemented...
No one should have a right to a double-digit return on their investment.
No one has a right. That's not... No,
what are you talking
no
about?
One's in the, that's not in the Constitution, but we, what we see
what?
Is that when we implement a rent freeze, we have landlords who are crying that the government is going to put them out of business.
Okay. They're trying, you know, look, I've been a landlord, okay? And one thing that was important to me as a landlord is that the mortgage was covered.
Yes.
I was able to cash flow a little bit, and I had some pretty good tenants. I was very lucky. It was just my home in the city. I don't know if it was 12% or whatever it was, but that's unreal. Look, the guy was caught in a, you know, position where he didn't even know how to answer the questions.
Well, these people don't actually know anything.
But that's what they want.
Yes.
And there are young, this is what's dangerous about this. You can kind of write this off as just something that's fringe in the Democrat Party.
It's not.
It's not. And that's what I think Bill Maher is on to. Listen to Bernie. He's rattling off all the victories.
Within the last year, we have won mayor's races in New York City, Zoran Mogdani. We've won mayor's races in Seattle, Washington, Washington, D.C. We have won congressional elections and Democratic primaries in Arizona, Ohio, Pennsylvania, California, Montana, Colorado, New Jersey, and New York.
And will Missouri be the next one with Cori Bush 2 weeks from tomorrow? I think that's a legitimate question. We'll take a break here at the top of the hour when we return. I do want to talk about the Odyssey just a little bit because the numbers were really incredible and it kind of overcame the woke label. Do you eat kale, Sue?
Sometimes.
Okay, I got a question about kale that I'm going to, you know, kind of give to the crew here after the top of the hour. And then a real interesting story about a guy that bought a house sight unseen and discovered something. Have you had, you do real estate. Have you had clients that have done that?
What?
Buy a house on sight unseen.
I've only had it happen once on the internet.
I have a friend who did it. I thought he was nuts, but it was in a very competitive, you know, market about, yeah, you know, 10 years ago. And he wanted the house, and it turned out well. But this one's a little different. I'll share that coming up after Fox News.
Get more at 971talk.com.